afternoon, good morning for some. This is Robert Firevid, and this is the second in of our teleseminar series in feedstock logistics. The presenter today is going to be Paul Nikitovich of Bioenergy Investments. He's going to talk about the BriPill technology. Just a couple of things before we start. One of the problems that we had in the last teleconference was that background noise from people's phones. So we ask that if you have a mute button on your phone to please use it unless you're speaking. Alternatively, you could use the star 6 feature and that will mute your line, and you can unmute it by again pressing star 6. But hopefully this will prevent the interruptions we had before. Also want to make sure everyone understands that while Paul is giving his presentation, if there is a burning question that you need to ask to clarify something in his slide or in his presentation that he's currently on, you can come in and ask your question. But please otherwise save your questions until the end of his presentation. So again, welcome everyone. And I, at this point, am going to call in the operator who will let us know that we're going to be taped.
Thank you. This is the conference coordinator, and I would just like to remind all participants that this conference call is being recorded today, and if you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And sir, you may begin.
Okay. Well, my name is Paul Nikitovich, and I have a company called Bioenergy Investments. Basically, we acquired the rights for a Brazilian technology that processes basically ag residues. It started with bagasse and wood waste, but we've done all kinds of tests with Stover and other types of like elephant grass also. And basically, this equipment can process all of those things. The person who started it, the inventor, has been working with ag residues and wood waste for 20-some-odd years, and he has a little pellet operation and a briquetting operation. And basically, this came out of that, where he took his own ideas to be able to speed up the briquetting process. And he divides power between various piston heads to increase the speed compared to traditional briquetting methods.
Paul, are you ready to start?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, I was just speaking. I didn't know if anybody heard me or not.
Yep. Yep. You're on and you're being recorded.
Okay. Okay. So basically, I don't know if anybody heard the. I was speaking just a minute ago, but I don't know if anybody heard me. I have acquired the rights. My company, Bioenergy Investments, acquired the rights to this BriPill technology that was developed in Brazil by a person called Carlos Fraza. He has two companies there. Successful briquetting operation that started off briquetting wood waste and eventually started doing it with ag residues. And he developed this technology through working with biomass residues for some 20-odd years, which is pretty innovative in that its energy costs are pretty low, along with its drying costs, the spare parts costs compared to traditional pelletizing or briquetting operations. So we can now go here. Let's go to slide 2. This is with one line. It's a pretty compact little unit. And it processes about 12,000 to 15,000 tons per year of material, about 1,000 tons a month. Drier material, you can process it quicker. Okay. It works with just about most ag residues. We've been working basically a lot there in Brazil with bagasse from sugar cane, because you have a lot of sugar plants close by, sugar and ethanol plants. But we've done all kinds of tests with other types of residues, with corn stover and elephant grass and wood wastes and mixes and everything else. Okay, it can actually process material residues up to 65-70% moisture. It's just over 60% obviously is going to slow your production rate down a lot, but you can still process the stuff. It just, there's a lot more moisture to get out of there. And the question is, how much fines can you get to fuel the drier, the wetter the material is? Okay. Very low energy consumption on this, 150 kVA. Comes out on an average to about 70 to 80 kilowatts per hour. I'm not taking into consideration here a grinder. He uses a small grinder there, but it depends on the size of what you want to put in that, you know, as far as for the scale of the plant. Okay, low maintenance cost. You've got basically about eight components that are your spare parts. Some obviously have a much longer lifespan than others. And this depends also upon the abrasiveness of your biomass. With ag residues, you're always dealing with a lot of dirt, silica, and that has an effect, obviously, on the wear of your components. Okay, and the system has an automated system with all kinds of controls built into it, so that you don't damage like the main components of the motor of the compactor. It'll shut down before that. Okay. Okay, so here's a third slide, how to turn residues into a viable energy commodity. Well, really the main things are how do you reduce the handling costs? Because when you're looking at like bagasse, you're talking about something that you have right there, a big supply right there that's already shredded and everything else. When you're looking into ag residues in the field where they have to be collected and shipped, that's it's a totally another ball game. And so you really want to try to lower everything down. If you're trying to turn this into a commodity, you're looking at very small margins. And then a very important factor is how do you get the farmers to participate? Because these are not dedicated areas. You have to get the farmers. It has to be interesting for the farmer to participate in this operation. Otherwise, you know, it's just numbers. It's not realistic. So with farmer participation, you know, you're looking at various models. You're looking at either a co-op model, like what Show Me Energy is doing in Missouri, or you can have them participate as shareholders so that they have revenue on the back end, or you can have a model where you actually contract out and pay them a certain amount, and you do all the baling and collection. Okay, and so what I've looked at here, we've done some work with Byron Weathers, who's the president of the Colorado Corn Growers Association, and with Paul Kenny in Kearney, Nebraska, who's already been working on this, on the logistics side of this operation, as far as for the baling and bringing all that in. And you can look at your baling costs and shipping and all that to about $32 a ton. And then you add about 15 or 20 to the farmer if he's just going to sell you the material. And basically, you say,
"Excuse me, Paul. This is Bob Firevid. I want to ask again. We're getting some extraneous noise. If you have a mute button on your phone, please mute your phone. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, please press *6, and your line will be muted. If you want to unmute it to ask a question, you can press *6 again. Thank you."
Okay, so here, obviously, the idea is with this model, with the Repel system, you can scale it, but you're really looking at one or two lines. If you want to keep your transportation costs down to a minimum, and so what we looked at here was basically, if we go to next slide. We're looking at here stover or other crops, but the stover, really the main thing is that's an ag residue. You're not having a dedicated crop. Now you can obviously have different types of crops where you can have different collection periods for those crops. But once again, that depends upon, you know, the farmer and what he thinks about that, the economic side of that equation. Okay. These burpels, once compacted, are anywhere from 40 to 45 pounds per cubic foot. Okay. We've done tests where they've mixed it with coal. It's worked very well. Or burned by itself. Or turning it into cellulosic ethanol, or they're very good for gasification, for combined heat and power. Okay, and obviously with the densification, you've brought down your shipping cost afterwards if you're shipping into to a plant. Okay, let's go to slide 5. So the feedstock area is important as far as for your feedstock requirements, and once again, you're producing 12,000 to 15,000 tons, depending on the moisture content. It's going to depend upon how much material you're going to need. But you want to try to keep that distance of bringing in that feedstock to about 10 miles, 10 to 15 miles. So for a plant this size, that's just about ideal. You're looking at, if we go to the next slide, you're looking at about, if it's a dedicated, totally dedicated area, maybe about 50 circles. Okay, if you're looking at a realistic estimate of trying to get about 20% of the farmers in that area, then you're going up to about 150 to 200 circles. Okay, and once again, the main reason for this is really to try to keep your transportation costs down. When you have a big operation and you're processing a lot of pellets, you're talking about a much bigger radius, and those transportation costs start eating up your profit. Go to the next slide. So the biomass requirements. Okay, so this obviously it's a function of the amount of water in the biomass. If you have pretty dry material, you don't even have to put it through the dryer here. You can just compact it directly. Okay, you're going to have that shredder in the beginning, and you want to bring it down to about, ideally, an inch, but it'll process between an inch and 2 inches. Okay, and so at 15% or lower, you can actually feed it right into the compactor without going through the dryer. You're going to use in the dryer about 8 to 12% of the fines. When it's going through, it's like a rotary drum, but that has all kinds of pieces of equipment that are turning the material and breaking it up as it goes through there. And you will, obviously, if it's the drier material, you're going to use less fines than if it's a wetter material. But as a rule of thumb, you can look at about 8 to 12% of the biomass as it goes in. That's going to be used to run the dryer. So you don't have any outside source. We have an operation that we're doing with Raceland Raw Sugar, and they put in gas just to start the thing up. Otherwise, normally you can start it up with the burpels itself. You have two little burners, and you start it up with that, and then it starts running off of that. But you're not going to run the operation off of the gas, okay? And so when the finished product normally has about anywhere from 8 to 14% moisture content in it, the compacted burpel. Okay. Go to the next slide. So this shows basically the volume. You know, so you've reduced the volume by tenfold from the material going in there. And calorific comparison, in reality it's three times, but if you're looking at it for a cubic meter standpoint, you're increasing it by up to 10 times. Here's the material we sent here to Midwest Labs, which shows you the analysis of it. BTU content was about 7,500. Stover, that's going to be about 7 to 7,500, but average, sometimes a little bit lower. And the moisture content was 11. ash content was 6. Most of your ag residues you're going to have anywhere between 4 and 6, 8, 10%. Okay. Here's just a picture to show you, give you an idea of how compacted it is. And that's like taking that little Bripel and putting it in a glass of water, and you can see how it the volume difference once it's been compacted down. So here we're comparing it with palletizing. And there was actually a very good study done by ORI, the ORI Institute in Minnesota, regarding palletizing ag residue. This was back in 2007 by Ken Campbell. Has a lot of interesting information on it. Their cost that they have actually for the pellet energy production was lower than this, but I've seen some operations firsthand, and show me energy. Their cost was about $10.80 to pelletize, because they were getting a lot of these costs from the manufacturer himself. And I don't think that this includes the drying operation either. So once again, here we're talking about 150 kVA, but the average is about 120. So you're looking at overall energy cost to run that one line, maybe about $60,000 a year. Okay, there's no hammer mill necessary. You just have the shredder or the grinder, whatever you want to call it, in the beginning. And then, like I said, the drying system is pretty unique in that it's using the fines. You have other types of dryers here where they use the biomass itself. I think this is more efficient. Okay. Another interesting feature here is that the material, when it's going through the dryer, it eliminates a lot of the dirt and rocks fall out at the bottom. It's like a screen, and it sifts it out when it's getting turned in there. So the heavier material is falling out of the bottom, and that's mainly rocks and dirt. Okay, so the cost that we've seen for the spare parts is around $5 a ton. Here you have a list, and put the picture. There's a picture with all the other components. But anyway, this gives you an idea of the shelf lives, and obviously that depends upon the abrasiveness of the material. I mean, if you have a material that has a lot of dirt and rocks that you don't get rid of a good part, it's going to wear out your dyes a lot faster. But the same goes with pelletizing. And what I've seen with pelletizing is you don't have these ways to filter out that silica. And that's really the main thing that wears your equipment out. Okay, here's a picture of slide 13. Showing the dimensions. Okay. So you have there in the feed going into the plant. There you're looking at about 300 liters of feedstock that are to be put in there per minute. And so that's about coming out on the other side is about 30 kilos per minute. So you're looking at about 18 cubic meters per hour. You're processing about 1,800 kilos per minute, per hour, excuse me. Okay. And once again, depending if you have material that's pretty dry, you're going to increase that production. Okay. The next slide. Oh yeah, and so here it's also it's pretty easy to ship. It's 2 40-foot containers. The one with the dryer is a 40-foot flat rack. It's a wide load, but we're working on cutting those cyclones down a little more so that you can fit it all into 2 40-foot containers. Okay. And here we go to pictures. There's a picture of the dryer. Here's one that's exposed, and then it's insulated here. insulating material, fiberglass, that, okay, maintain the internal temperature higher. And here's a picture of the compactor. So basically, there's five piston heads, and then there's a series of screws that inject the material. It flows out through a hopper at the top, goes into a chamber, and then it's pressed down, and then it comes out of these little ends here. And you can, depending on how your system is, you normally have a series of pipes that either regulate the speed of those pieces coming out of there. And then you're either putting it into another hopper to be dumped into two bags, big bag system, or directly into a truck load. Here's the control panel. So it's it's touch screen, and there's all kinds of sensors for the heat and the humidity on the system, and there's various built-in safety features to avoid problems, like within the dryer. There's a blow-off valves that the temperature gets too high in there. But everything is registered. You can see it all on the panels. The touchscreen control panel. That's slide 17. So it's pretty easy to operate. Okay, now here's a plant layout. Now here, basically, you can use the same layout to put in two lines. Now, obviously, if you want more space to store more material, then you would just increase the size of the plant there. Here's a two-line layout, the next line, 19. There. So at the end there, you can add that. Once again, you can add a turntable baghouse at the end where the material is coming out there. Or, like I said, feed it directly into bins and or trucks that come right in there and truck load. So the labor requirements are four operators. If they've been doing it for a while, you can run it on three, but we're looking at four. One at the dryer, one at the control room, one at the bagging operation, and one supervisor. And you can use, basically, to run two lines, you can add another person and run the two lines there. And then equipment costs, delivered, we had this is the cost, FOB Brazil from Santos with a year of spare parts and training of personnel and equipment assembly. Equipment assembly, you can do it relatively quickly, a couple weeks, two to three weeks, you have the plant up and running. And then here's a little background on this, Carlos Fraza, who's been working with briquettes and pellets for 20 years. Basically, that's it. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Paul.
You're welcome.
Oh, okay, I have a small question.
Sure.
This is Sam Tiggle from DOE. You have some numbers, but I don't recall. Do you have any number like so many dollars per dry ton or something? What kind of cost would those briquettes be?
Well, that's depends on your feedstock. The main thing is on your feedstock. How much is your feedstock going to be? Yeah.
Oh, do you have any costs like processing costs? I think you had in some form. Whatever is the feedstock cost, dollar per ton,
yeah,
extra moisture. then the processing cost would be, you said 150 kilowatt or KVA?
150 KVA, yeah, and but your average is about 120. So
okay.
you're looking at 70 some kilowatts an hour.
What is it, kilowatts per hour? Do you say per so many tons or something, or is it just
the energy cost that we were looking at, the average is about $5 per ton.
$5 per ton.
Now, the labor obviously depends on where you're at and what your labor cost is going to be. Yeah, and then the biomass, the other one, the feedstock, which is really your main cost, is how much is that going to be? I was just trying to give a realistic estimate of what the stover would be if you're looking at the operation of the baling and all that, and the farmer getting at least $15 to $20 per ton, then you're looking at about $50 for the stover. Okay?
Okay.
And once again, it depends on what's your feedstock.
On your transportation, you said about bulk density is about, I guess, 45, 43 to 55, something like that?
That's between 40 to 45.
Okay.
You're looking at between 600 to 700 kilos per cubic meter.
So basically, as per here in U.S., you couldn't load the entire truck with this density, right? That will be overweight.
What we were looking at with those baling pictures that you saw before,
mm-hmm.
They were looking there at the square bales that are about 800 pounds, and you're getting about 72 bales on there. So that's about 57,000 pounds. You're right at the maximum load there. But you get with the square bales, you're getting more than with the round bales where you're at about 50,000 pounds.
Yeah, I'm talking after you got those briquettes.
Yeah. Well, the briquettes, yeah, you're going to be limited by the maximum load.
Yeah, yeah.
You can only get, the maximum is about 57,000 pounds after you add the rig to that.
One last question is that the line, you said 12 to 15,000 tons per year. Am I correct?
Right, for one
okay.
line.
Okay, now.
You can put two lines and double that.
Can this machine be scaled up?
As far as for the production of the machine itself,
yes,
has not been worked on yet. I would imagine yes, but that would be the drawings for that are not on ready yet.
Okay, all right, thank you. Thanks.
Excuse me. This is John Tallhauser. I'm with ADM. I was wondering if I could ask a question. The
sure.
12,000 to 15,000 tons per year, is that based on running it like 8 hours a day, 5 days a week?
Five days a week, 6 days a week.
6 days a week, 8 hours a day.
You're looking at about 48 tons a day.
Okay, thank you. Okay. And also, is there... Or are there any of these machines currently operating and available to see in the U.S.?
Raceland Raw Sugar in Louisiana. They're a part of the Billy Patou Group. They're the biggest sugar producers in Louisiana.
And they're making they're using it for stover? Or?
No, they're making bagasse.
Bagasse, okay. Sorry if I missed that part.
Right. The basically, with the bagasse, he started off making with bagasse because that region where he's at, has a lot of sugar and ethanol plants. The big difference there with the bagasse is that you have something that's already been processed,
it's
shredded and everything else. Whereas with stover, you've got this additional cost to go out and get it and all that.
But for bagasse, you mentioned you need to use a shredder. Am I correct?
Yes. The bagasse is already shredded. When you're getting the sugar, all the juice out of that.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's going through and being ground.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes out to about, about an inch to 2 inches around there, about an inch normally.
Paul, I have, this is Shahab from Oak Ridge. Have you done testing of this machine on moisture contents that you quoted here, like on 60% moisture, and see how it works?
Yes. We've done it because bagasse has a much bagasse averagely is about a 50% moisture content.
What kind of capacity you get when say you're at 60% moisture?
You get a lot. You get lower because obviously the more you have water in there, the less material you're going to have in there.
Yeah, we know. But what what sort of that numbers you have for that? Do you have any numbers for that? Because most of the clover that is harvested, you know, at the time, it's fairly high in moisture.
Correct.
Especially in, on the bottom part of the stalks. It's not like sugar cane. So there may be a problem there in terms of moisture content to deal with that high moisture.
What kind of moisture are you looking at?
Say 40-50%.
40-50%? Well, no. The sugar cane, the bagasse that comes out of the sugar plant is always at about 50% average.
Yeah.
Now, when it sits around, for example, in Louisiana, since it's really, you're right at sea level and it's very humid, it collects actually moisture as it sits around there. They can come out of the thing and they have these big, huge piles of the material, but it'll sit around there, and after a day or two, the moisture content will actually increase in the bagasse. It's amazing. It collects moisture from the air. Now, obviously, if you're certain, you're places where you're a little higher up, it's a different story. There's a lot of variables there. But the processing is about, if you're getting up higher, then you're obviously making less material at the end that's coming through because you're getting rid of more water. So you have less material at the end because of that. And you have a little bit, it's a slower process to get more fines to fuel the dryer. Okay? Now, that's what I'm saying. If it's a material that's drier, if it's 40, 30, you're going to process it faster. But you're looking at about, like I said, the volume entering into that machine is about 300 liters per minute.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay? So when you're coming out at the back end, 30 kilos, if it's more moisture in it, that's at about a 50% moisture. If there's more moisture, it's going to slow that down. You're going to have less material coming out of there.
Paul, this is Maynard Heron with AgCo. What length does the particle need to be reduced to prior to going into the briquetting unit?
The ideal size is about an inch, but we've had it about a little bit more. We've had it like a little bit about 2 inches, a little bit below. But when it's about an inch is the ideal size, and when it's going through the big drum, the dryer, it breaks up a lot of the material.
Okay. What are the dimensions of the briquettes?
They're about, let's say about an inch and a half, 2 inches in height, inch across, inch and a half across,
mm-hmm.
About five centimeters.
Okay.
Yes.
At what diameter are they then? Is that the inch and a half?
Excuse me?
What diameter?
Yeah, about an inch and a half.
Okay.
An inch and a half. And the length, see, the length, they break off at about an inch and a half, 2 inches. They can have longer pieces. They're going up those chutes. They go up these long chutes, and that you can regulate the tension in the chute. So you can actually make it a little denser or less dense, the material. As it's going through the piston heads, and then it's going up into these chutes, and it's getting compacted in there also, okay? And so that, you can regulate the tension of that. You can have pieces that come out a little bit bigger, but normally that's about the average, couple inches.
Hey.
Yeah.
This is Ed Oltoff, Cedar Falls Utilities.
Oh, how are you doing, Ed?
Good, Paul. How are you?
Very good.
Good to hear you, too. We had some material that was really low moisture this spring. Last spring, we harvested grasses from a prairie plot here. And it came out like 5 to 6% moisture. Can you feed this stuff directly in without going through the drying?
Yeah, you could just put it into the compactor. That's really low, though. 5 to 6%, wow.
Well, yeah, it's sat out all winter.
Yeah, because normally your average, even if it's really dry, is about 8 to 10.
Mm-hmm. But this was, harvested in the spring. It had stood all winter. Uh-huh. It wasn't baled or anything. It was just loose.
Uh-huh.
So it was really, really low moisture content when we ran it through.
And now there you wouldn't even have to go through the dryer. You just have to shred it up and put it right into the
Would that low moisture be a problem for the sticking together? Would you want to add some moisture to it at that point?
That's what I'm saying. It's kind of strange to be that low. Normally the lignin in there, you're going to have at least about 8 to 10. To have it down below that is pretty rare. But I would imagine that because that's what binds it is the lignin. So I would imagine because with the see the thing when you're pressing it, there's a lot of heat that's generated in there too.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had it cubed.
You had it cubed.
Yeah, and it didn't stick together at all.
It did not at all.
No.
Uh huh. It was a cuber.
Yes. Now I don't know if there's. I think yours are more tightly packed. If I can assume something correctly there.
Yeah.
And maybe that will help to get it stick together. But with the pressures of the cuber, it was not sufficient to even get it to bind.
Uh huh.
And you don't need any binders at all.
No,
in
not
the
at
process.
All.
If you use not something like bagasse with a 40%, it's all glued really well together.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing the strength of bagasse, for example. It's one of the strongest materials. You can't shear that fiber, and so that's why with your dyes and all that, there's certain components of the dyes that wear out quicker than like the tip, the piston head, and there's like a little cone that has to be kind of tapered to come in. And obviously, the bigger the taper, you lower your production rate, but you will avoid it from breaking out. The material becomes so strong, if you don't feed it right, the amounts enough, then it will start compacting so much, and the material will become like steel. It's incredible how you have these little briquettes that are like, and that will then break off the piston tip, but then that will stop the machine, so you don't screw up the motor.
Okay. How about moisture resistance? Are they really susceptible to water? Once they're briquetted, or once they're
if you don't want to leave it covered, like I said, this is compacted fiber.
Mm-hmm.
If it's gonna rain on it, it'll start coming back to its original state.
Yeah, how about just moisture?
That's why I had that picture of the glass of water.
Mm-hmm.
You put that in a glass of water, it'll just come right back up to it like it was before.
Yeah. Just moisture in the air, though. I mean, do you have a shelf life on this material once it's made?
Oh, that's an interesting question. No, I haven't seen that. I've seen them more get drier, but then again, I don't know if it was like at sea level. I don't know. That's an interesting question. I couldn't say for sure. I would imagine because when it goes into the dryer, it hits a... They don't biodegrade. They get hit by a really high thermal shock right in the beginning, which will kill off any of the bacteria in there. So they don't, it doesn't like biodegrade. But then again, as far as for humidity, moisture content in the air, I don't know. I've seen them more where they dry out more, over time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe it's because
they become more fragile.
Because it's tighter packed or something. That was one of the problems we had when we cubed is that they could really absorb moisture just out of the air, and that helped them disintegrate too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen them. I've seen them become drier. Where that when they're you're mixing them around, it breaks down a little more. But that takes a long time. Normally, I've had samples sitting here for a long time, and that's more with when I'm looking more at the stuff made with pine than with the bagasse.
Okay.
Paul, I have a little question. I don't know exactly the principle inside. Normal pelletizing machine, you push it through those holes or dies and...
Right, right. Whatever. There it's turning inside a drum, and it's pushing it through the little holes and cutting it with a knife.
Okay. Is there any pressure number that can be compared with normal pelletization?
It's a totally different process here. What you're doing here, see, when you're pelletizing, you've pulverized that material down to lower than a quarter of an inch.
Right.
And then you're putting it in there. You can't pulver. You can't make it too much powder when you're pelletizing, because then it won't bind right.
Mm-hmm.
But here it's different. It's a lot bigger particle size.
Okay.
Okay.
there's a lot, let's say there's more fiber in there. So you're eliminating that step of having to go through that hammer mill and bringing it down to a much smaller size.
So
what you're doing pelletizing. And also sometimes in pelletizing, you have to add moisture to it to be able to bind correctly afterwards. So you're increasing various steps, which obviously increase your energy costs a lot.
Okay. So because it is energy efficient because of the process, right? It is not the normal pelletization process, but...
No. You've eliminated a couple steps.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, just comparing with the cubing, what's the difference in that part? Now, the drying we understand, but...
I don't know specifically of the cubing. I know of briquetting operations, okay? And briquetting operations, they're pounding it. Okay, they're putting the material in, shredded up, and then they're pounding it with one big piston head, and then it's chopping the briquettes, okay? And that process is a lot slower, and the equipment breaks down a lot more. I'm not familiar enough with cubing to tell you.
Well, I'm just, you know, thinking where the energy conservation comes into place. Is it in drying part? Is it in compaction part? Where is that?
The energy conservation is one thing is the dryer, okay? So your dryer, you're fueling it with a percentage of the fines.
We do that, of course, you know, in all of our dryers now, we use biomass to heat up dryers, so.
Right.
What we do, yeah.
Depends on how you're feeding that to dry it.
Mm-hmm.
This is basically just using the fines that are being recirculated, okay, and that feed the flames once you get it running. So it's a pretty efficient way to do it. Instead of having to feed it directly, you only in the beginning do you put some of the little briquettes in there to get it going. Afterwards, it's the fines that are being broken up through the drum that go through the cyclones that come back around and feed the flame. So it's a much more efficient manner than feeding biomass directly, feeding your briquettes directly to keep the thing going all the time. And then the other energy thing is, like I said, you don't have that hammer mill, and you don't have that. Yeah, you have to then sometimes have to add moisture again, etc. You have various other steps that increase your costs for pelletizing.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jude from Penn State.
Excuse me?
What's the rate of equipment replacement? Let's say, how many hours you have to stop and get your facility cleaned?
Normally, that's once a week or once every 2 weeks, depending on your material, how abrasive that material is. You have a list of the components there that I showed you, and there's certain ones, obviously, that have a much... lower shelf life than the other ones. You know, the piston, point of the piston, and the cone inside where it's coming in, and that the tip of that cone, where really it's like the die, and that those are the components that wear out quicker.
So it's a wetter, so you got stopping more often.
Excuse me.
I mean, the material is wet, you know, more a lot more moisture content. So you have to stop.
It's more how abrasive it is.
Mm.
Once again, if you get material that's got a lot of dirt in it, silica, that's really going to wear out your stuff a lot faster.
Okay, that's good.
If you're doing it, they do it with pine waste and stuff like that. It goes a lot longer. That you don't have to change it out. But gas is very abrasive, especially if you have, a high silica content in there. That's another thing. Why, as far as with ag residues, it's a problem. People that say that their spare parts cost is $3 or $4, that's not true. It's a lot higher than that. But, a lot of the equipment manufacturers will say that, and there's no way. Not if you're dealing with ag residues and you're pulling that off the field, and it depends on how that's done also.
Oh, this is Corey Radke at Shell. Do you have an idea what temperature your burner gets to?
Good question. To tell you
right off the top of my head. No, I do have an answer to that. I can email you that, but just to tell you off my top of my head right now, no, it hits a high. The average is about, let's see, thinking in centigrade. It hits a pretty high temperature right in the very beginning. It's got like a thermal shock of about 400 some centigrade, and then it goes way down to about 90.
Okay, so further. 400 C is about the max or so, is that right?
Yeah, right at the very beginning.
And I came in a little late. I apologize if you already mentioned it. On a separate note, do you have an idea of what sort of legs and conveyance systems your rappels take? Can you use grain handling infrastructures?
I was speaking with a guy the other day about that too. I would think for the flow, I don't know. This would have to be tested, to tell you the truth.
Okay,
so if you could use a thing like with the grain, with a truck for grain, and put it in there and see if it would flow out. I don't know if that would if it would how do you call it? Right at the end.
Yeah, if it would break your arch or rattle.
Bridge. It would bridge. Yeah, I'm not. I don't. That has not been done. Be tested yet.
Okay, that's just an unknown, but it's nice and dense anyway.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Paul, what is the size of your briquettes or whatever you call normally?
They're about an inch and a half in diameter, and they can vary anywhere from an inch or two to three inches in length. Like I said, okay. they're going up these chutes, and they break off at the top, and they fall into the bin. But you can, like I said, you can adjust the chutes to make it a little more compact as they're going up.
Okay, so it could flow through the chutes and pass through the conveyors and stuff like that. So-called grain handling question just now we had.
It comes out of the chute, and then either there you can fill it into another hopper and put it in, then bag it to big bags, or you can just have a truck come up and just feed it into the truck.
Thank you.
Paul, this is Richard Haig with USDA. I had a question about your feedstock area, and you describe, I think, in slide 6 about these circles and looking at a 10 to 15 mile radius.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea then, is to have one plant in each one of those circles, potentially one line, to reduce the transportation costs, I guess.
Right, well, the circles are so many acres, you know.
Right.
Circles, so what you're looking at with, if you're looking at like a township, you know, you have what, about 6 miles or so?
Right, 6 by 6, 36
yeah.
square miles.
So if you're looking then, once again, if you say, okay, it's a dedicated area, you know, I just took this at looking at Corn Stover, you know, speaking with like I said, Byron Weathers, who's the president of the Corn Growers Association in Yuma here in Colorado, and then looking at taking off a certain amount sustainably, so they could get like 4 tons an acre, they would take off about 2.
Right.
And then calculating that per acre to basically get that idea of about 50, a dedicated area of about 50 circles. But he said, realistically looking, you're not going to see that getting everybody involved. Maybe you will, but, you know, let's say realistically, you'll get maybe 20%.
Right. I think you're correct there.
Right. Because you want to make it a realistic thing. Otherwise, it's like, you know, it was like in the beginning, a lot of the cellulosic guys, oh, yeah, we're going to get this material for $10 from the farmer. That's, you know, that's just not true.
Right.
So that's your key consideration, really, is the participation of the farmer. You know, what's the model? Is it a co-op? Are they going to invest in an operation? They might, because then they're going to get money on the back end. Or do you have an operation where you do all the collection for them and you pay them a specific amount, which is probably in the $15 to $20 range per ton?
Yeah, and I think you're realistic in pointing out that it won't be 100% participation.
Yeah.
These corn areas, they're also rotating a lot of them with soybeans.
That's right.
And if we look at other biomass crops, you're right. But your ideal still is this 10 to 15 mile radius for each line, for a one line.
Yeah, because you want to keep that cost, that transportation cost down.
Right.
If you start talking about, you know, these operations that want to process a bunch of material, 60,000, 100,000, et cetera, they're going to get killed on the bringing in the stuff from the outer areas.
Yeah.
The transportation cost is going to be $20, $30 a ton. I mean, that just doesn't make it viable. And when you start looking at this to make a viable commodity out of this, then your margins are pretty small. You know, and so then you're getting into the energy part of the equation and the transportation part of the equation, and that's key, you know, to whether this thing is going to work or not. And then how does the farmer participate, too? You want to try to see how to guarantee your feedstock. Because if you can't guarantee your feedstock, then, you know, if the farmers, you don't have a long-term contract of 5-7 years or something, how are you going to make it work? Oh, okay, well, they're making a lot of money. We're going to go up on our price for our material. And there your model goes, it's gone. So the farmer has to participate in some way. You know, whether, like I said, if it's a co-op or they could get some type of advantage to come in on the operation where they're going to get paid on the back end.
Well, which is the sort of the scenario in some cases with these co-ops and these ethanol plants. They did.
That's right.
They bought in and...
Exactly. These pictures that I got here are from the guys in Kearney, Nebraska. They got a big operation, a logistics operation, how to bale it correctly and cheap. This is where I'm getting the numbers from. I mean, I'm not inventing this.
Paul, this is Tom Richard from Penn State. This technology is clearly got really good applications in combustion processes and thermochemical conversion. I'm wondering if one were to use this at the front end to supply a biochemical conversion process where you might need to go through a pretreatment system and presumably have to break apart these briquettes in order to do so.
Mm.
Do you have any estimates as what the energy implications might be in terms of breaking this back down to the powder?
Into the fiber.
Right,
I don't know if there's any, if there's a difference, if you're talking about in cellulosic ethanol, if there's a difference between a pellet to get in the cellulosic or between the this briquette, which is a lot more fiber in it, obviously. I don't know about that, but as far as we're breaking it down, no, I don't think that's a complicated thing. You can have like a grate and break it right back down. It depends. You want to do what with it exactly at the end?
Well, if you were going to break it back down into, you know, roughly 2-millimeter chunks, particles, you know, would you have to hammer mill it back down to that size? Would it crush?
Well, you're breaking it down for what purpose? What do you want to do with it?
In order to pre-treat the material to get penetration of, for example, a dilute acid and pressurized system.
Okay, now...
I'm just, you know, if one were to look at a biochemical downstream process,
right.
It's really got some advantages in terms of moving the stuff to the central refinery.
But you want to break it down to that small.
Well, I'm not actually sure how these pretreatment system how deep they would penetrate. Generally, the pilot work that has been done has been with fairly finely ground material.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you stir it vigorously in liquid, will this become an emulsion or some kind of, will it get into water? I mean, you said, I think, earlier, with a lot of moisture added, it could disintegrate or shelf life and something.
Wouldn't disintegrate. It would turn back into its fiber form.
That's what you need, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I put that slide in that shows you, basically, of one little compact thing, and then in a glass of water. It was put into a glass of water. And this was, I don't know what slide it was. Oh, you heard it. It was slide 10. So you have a picture of that one little Propel in a glass of water. We put it in a glass of water that was about half full, and that's what happened.
So there
that's
is
the
no...
material in that one little Propel, that's it in the glass. It's an original. It's original state. So you can see how much volume the difference is.
So you're saying that there should not be any problem. There should not be much resistance for biochemical treatment.
No, I don't think so at all. If he wants to get into a very small size, that's a lot smaller, a couple millimeters, and that's like a powder. Mm-hmm. That's a different story.
Well, this fiber may be that in its narrowest dimension. I'm not just concerned about the long dimension. But So you're clarifying for me that this picture with a cup is actually a reversible process.
Correct. You just take it and, you, like I said, you put it in a glass of water, boof, comes back up. This is why I thought that this could actually have interesting use in mixing it with grains, with wet distilled grains. But, you know, that's another test and everything else, where you could actually compact it down, then ship it dry like that, and then use it as a feed. and they add a little water to it, and both, you have a feed there. So that would be an interesting thing for ethanol plants.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we're at the end of our hour, folks. Are there any burning questions that anyone wants to ask? I noticed that I forgot to ask Paul to put his email address, or I forgot to put his email address on his first slide. So, Paul, if you don't mind, I'll just send everybody your email address in case they want to contact you.
Sure, no problem.
Okay.
You have the website there, too, that has more details.
Yeah. So, if there are no more burning questions, I'd like to, again, thank Paul for a great presentation, and thank you all for great questions. We do have another teleseminar that's scheduled for Tuesday in 2 weeks. That'll be April 27th. Am I have it right? No, I've got it May 4th.
I think May 4th you said, right.
May 4th, I'm sorry. Yep, May 4th. And it'll be John Cundiff of Virginia Tech will be talking about his work in logistics. So thus, put that down on your calendar, please. Well, thank you all again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.